chapter 20. This is our outline. I'm just going to get to the chapter itself. So war against Benjamin. I promise you, some of you came in a little bit late. There is kind of an almost pleasant ending to all of this. Okay? Not for these people who are certainly about to die, but for others. Okay? All the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba, that's from way up north to way down south. All right? Beersheba is the well at the very bottom of all of Israel in the southernmost part. It's within the tribal limits of Simeon. So that was an expression, from Dan to Beersheba. And also from the land of Gilead came out, and the community assembled as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. The leaders of all the people and of the tribes of Israel placed themselves in the assembly of God's people, 400,000 soldiers on foot with drawn swords. That's approaching 500,000, right? That's a lot of guys. That's not very different from their numbers during the Exodus. They had about 500,000 warriors, and we estimate that would have been about one quarter of the total population. That's how we come up with 2 million people coming out of Egypt. So, the Benjamites heard that the Israelites had gone up to Mizpah. The Israelites said, "Tell us how this thing happened." The Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, "I went to Gibeah in Benjamin with my concubine to spend the night. And during the night, the men of Gibeah came to attack me and surrounded the house at night. They intended to kill me, but they raped my concubine." He left out the part about, "I shoved her out the door." So he's spinning a little bit here. "They raped my concubine and she died. Then I took my concubine and cut her into pieces and sent her to each part of Israel's territory because they have committed this wicked and disgraceful thing in Israel. Now all of you are Israelites, speak your judgment, give your verdict." Then all the people stood as one man and said, "None of us will go to his tent or return to his house." We've been hearing in the news a lot lately about a speedy trial. This is speedy judgment also. Right now, today. "Now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up and attack it by lot." That doesn't mean that they're going to throw dice at it. It means, well, how many of you know where the village of Esig is? Could you attack Esig with 1 million soldiers? Where would you put them all, right? So they have to decimate their numbers. Too many guys showed up. So we'll take 10 men out of every 100. 10% of all the tribes of Israel. 1,000 out of 10,000 will go get provisions for the soldiers. And then when they go to Gibeah in Benjamin, they will punish them for all the disgraceful things they committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered as one man against the city. The tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin saying, did we come across the number actually? Well, 10%, 400,000 will become how many? 40,000? Yeah, more manageable. And about the size of Benjamin, by the way. So in Greek, we would say the isos pros isos, equals before equals. That's what they're doing. The tribe of Israel, did I just act like you knew Greek? I'm sorry. I apologize. I asked you what I should change in my Bible class. Maybe that's one of the things. "What is this evil thing that has happened among you? Hand over the wicked men of Gibeah so that we can put them to death and purge this Israel from Israel." All they want are the offenders from Gibeah. Okay, they just want the guys who were at fault. But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. So now not only does the city rally around the guilty men, but the tribe rallies around the guilty city. So it was going to just be the guilty men of Gibeah or maybe the city, but now it's spread out. It's the whole tribe of Benjamin is now under this storm cloud that's about to break. In fact, the Benjamites gathered together at Gibeah from their cities to go out and fight against the Israelites. On that day, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 men with swords from their cities. Besides those who lived in Gibeah, 700 elite young men. So more than 30,000 against about 40,000, right? Like I said, equals before equals. There were 700 elite young men from all these troops who were left-handed. All of them could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. A slinging stone is not the kind of stone you skip across a lake. A sling stone was about 1 pound, which incidentally is about the size of a what? Major league sports thing.
Baseball.
A baseball. It is estimated by experts who research this kind of stuff that a slinging stone from an expert like these guys, let go, that 1 pound stone, baseball sized, could probably achieve about 90 miles an hour, which is what our better professional pitchers do today. But I love it when they put in the shortstop, say 35 mile an hour pitch. That could be me. 35 mile an hour pitch, at least for the first couple, so. All right. The Israelites, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 men with swords, each one an experienced soldier. The Israelites went up to Bethel and inquired of God. They ask God at Bethel, which of us is to go first to fight against the Benjamites? And the Lord answered, and this is how the book started with Othniel. In the book of Judges, which of us will go down to fight first? And God said, Judah will go first. Now that's echoed here at the end. But now it's not against the Canaanites, it's against the Benjamins who have become like the Canaanites. The next morning, the Israelites rose up and camped near Gibeah. The men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin, took their battle positions against Gibeah. It's like the Australian sandwich spread. The Vegemites. The Benjamites, right? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich, right? The land down under. Okay. We got to get karaoke going again. All right. The Benjamites sallied out of Gibeah and slaughtered 22,000 men of Israel on the battlefield that day. After day one, the score is Benjamin 1, Israel nothing. They're ahead. The home team has the advantage here. Okay, 22,000 killed by Benjamin. But the men of Israel encouraged one another and again took their battle positions in the same place where they positioned themselves on the first day. They went up and wept before the Lord until evening and inquired of the Lord again. They said, "Shall we go up and attack our brothers, the Benjamites?" And the Lord answered, "Go up against them." So on the second day, the Israelites advanced once again against the Benjamites. That was a poorly phrased translation. That's my fault. Once again against the Benjamin. I should have said once more, shouldn't I? Anyway. That day the Benjamites sallied out from Gibeah to meet them and slaughtered another 18,000 Israelites on the field, all armed with swords. So day two, Benjamin 2, Israel 0, or Benjamin 20,000 or 40,000, Israel 0, not good. Oh, Marcia, what would Albert Einstein say about you? Do you know Einstein's statement? The definition of insanity is to do the same thing twice in a row and expect different results. Yeah, you got it exactly right. Maybe they should have done something different. Well, day three. Then all of the children of Israel, all of the people, went up to Bethel, where they wept and sat before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord. In the Bible, when you see burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, think of that. Do we have a burnt offering hallway? No, we have a fellowship hallway, right? Right? So burnt offering is worship. Fellowship is what? Picnic. Okay, when they offered fellowship offerings, they roasted the meat, but then they got to eat again. So burnt offerings and fellowship offerings means we're going to worship and we're going to eat. And they're going to get up their strength. So they fasted, the two offerings. Once again, the Israelites inquired of the Lord. In those days, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there, and Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, was serving before it. They asked, should we again fight against our brothers, the Benjamites, or not? This is the verse that tells us that these chapters probably happened in the first half of the book of Judges. Because Aaron died in the book of Numbers before they ever even got to the bronze snake incident. Aaron had already died on Mount Hor, south of Beersheba. So Moses faced the bronze snake without his brother. And they had already buried Miriam too. So Moses was the last one of the family. Then his son Eleazar, Aaron's son Eleazar, was the high priest for a while, but he was already pretty old when his dad died at 122 or 3. Aaron was older than Moses. And so Phinehas is the one who then takes over, I think even before Deuteronomy is over. If you remember, they camped at the time of Balaam, and Balaam got all the Moabite women to consort with the Israelites. They fell into sexual sins there. And one guy even brought his Moabite girl into the camp in the middle of everybody to obviously come and sleep with her in his tent. And Phinehas grabbed his spear and went in and ran them both through. He does like a shish kebab deal with them. And he's praised for it and so forth. Well, that guy is still around and alive at this time, Phinehas. So we're not that far into the how many years for the judges between the years 1400 BC and 1100 BC. So 300 some years. Is it 360? It's something like that. But for Phinehas to still be alive, we're early in that period. Maybe not all that long before the book of Ruth. I didn't bring this up before, but remember how hospitable the one guy is in the dad in Bethlehem in this story? Was that like a thing in Bethlehem? Because who else is really super hospitable in Bethlehem? Boaz. When Ruth shows up, no, it's okay if she gleans wrong, let her glean wrong. You know, if she takes from the shocks of the grain, just let her. It's okay. And if she does it wrong, just don't make fun of her. Don't play jokes on her. Don't criticize her. Just let her. And here I'm going to fill up, you know, hold up your skirt and I'll fill it up with extra grain. You go home and, you know, and stuff. So it's hospitality in Benjamin is in Bethlehem is a big, big deal. So anyway, they asked, should we go again or not? The Lord answered, fight, because tomorrow I will hand them over to you. So Israel set up an ambush around Gibeah. They changed their tactics, Marcia. On the third day, the Israelites fought against the Benjamites and took their battle positions against Gibeah as they had done before. They set up as if they're doing the same thing again. Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again. Then the Benjamites sallied out and were drawn away from the city. They began to attack the Israelites as before, and they killed about 30 men. Not 30,000, but about 30 men on the roads. One goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and through the fields. And the Benjamites said, hey, we're defeating them as before. So they sally out and they're heading off one direction. And we'll find out about 12,000 are a decoy to lure out the Benjamites. But the Israelites said, let's flee and draw them away from the city to the roads. So all the men of Israel withdrew from their lines and took up positions at Baal Tamar, while the Israelites who were waiting in ambush charged out of their places west of Gibeah. So it's a classic battle tactic to draw people into this kind of an ambush by simply retreating, and then they get in too far. In very famously, in Germany in World War II, if you look at that line, that battle line from above, it looks like a Battle of the Bulge, because there's like this weird thing going on. They're pressing out too far, and that's a problem for a commander. Don't let your forces, you know, go sticking out somewhere. sticking out. That happened at the Battle of Gettysburg, where at the Battle of Little Round Top, one of the colonels took his brigade out too far out, and they said he stuck out like a sore thumb. And then one of the other, I don't know if it was Chamberlain's brother or who it was, who said, "Don't worry, you'll see him tumbling back in a minute." And he was too far out, and they had to end up coming back because you get cut off from your. You got to form a straight line when you're fighting in this way. Then 10,000 elite men from all Israel made a frontal attack against Gibeah. That's the city now, not the men. So they've gotten behind them. The battle was so heavy that the Benjamites did not realize how close they were to disaster. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day the Israelites slaughtered 25,100 men of Benjamin, all armed with swords. Then the Benjamites knew that they had been defeated. So Benjamin falls here by this ambush. They're trying to get back, but that's not all. So the men of Israel had retreated before Benjamin because they trusted the ambush they had set against Gibeah. After all, they had the Lord's promise. The men waiting in ambush rushed quickly against Gibeah. They spread out and put the whole city to the sword. The prearranged signal between the men of Israel and the men waiting in ambush was this: when they made a great cloud of smoke rise from the city, the men of Israel should resume the battle. So we'll attack again when you see the smoke. And that's exactly what happens. The Israel catches and strikes down the fleeing men of Benjamin and destroys the city of Gibeah as well. So when Benjamin had begun to strike them down, killing about 30 men of Israel, this verse goes back to, remember when this was going on? They said, "They've been defeated before us, just as they were in the first battle, but when the column of smoke began to go up from the city, the men of Benjamin looked behind them, and the whole city was going up in smoke, rising into the sky." Remember that all of Benjamin rallied to Gibeah? They were all there. Men, women, children. Then the men of Israel attacked again, and the men of Benjamin were terrified when they realized that disaster was upon them. They turned their backs to the men of Israel and ran toward the wilderness. But the battle overtook them, and those who came out of the city slaughtered them. So they try to get into the hills, and they don't make it. They surrounded the Benjamites, pursued them, easily overtook them near Geba toward the east. They're heading for the river. There were 18,000 men who died from Benjamin, all elite soldiers. Then Benjamin turned and fled toward the desert to the rock of Rimmon. But Israel killed 5,000 men on the roads. They overtook them at Gidom and struck down 2,000 more. So diminishing returns because there aren't that many Benjamites left. They're finding the stragglers now. All the Benjamites who died that day were 25,000 elite soldiers armed with swords, but 600 men, a brigade, this number that keeps coming up in the Old Testament, fled into the desert to the rock of Rimmon and stayed there 4 months. The men of Israel turned back to Benjamin and killed them with the sword, that is the Benjamites. All the towns, the animals, everything that remained, they burned every town that was left. Benjamin is a smoking ruin. From the commander of the army to the lowly goldfish in the office, they were all done for. Okay, that's most of the blood. In the last chapter here, Israel grieves over the loss of Benjamin. We've lost a tribe today. And an oath has bound them from giving any of their wives to the survivors. So now a little bit of time passes, they cool down. The men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah: "None of us will give his daughter in marriage to a Benjamite." The people came to Bethel and sat there before God until evening. They wept loudly, they wept bitterly, and they prayed, "Why, O Lord God of Israel, has this happened in Israel that there is a tribe?" I've got a grammatical fault there. There is a tribe missing today. Well, the next morning, the next morning, the people rose early and built an altar there. They made burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Again, worship and eating. The people of Israel asked, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come when we assembled before the Lord? For they had taken a firm oath that anyone who failed to assemble before the Lord at Mitzpah would certainly be put to death. They wanted somebody from every town. Ooh, did somebody go from New Ulm? Dave went. Thank you, Dave. Okay. So, you know, that's kind of how all of this goes. Somebody went from every tribe. Did I finish that verse? Yeah. Now the Israelites had compassion on their brothers, the Benjamites. They said, today a tribe is cut off from Israel. What should we do about wives for those who are left? Since we've sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters as wives. There are 600 soldiers left. That's it for Benjamin. They said, what clan among the tribes of Israel did not come to the Lord at Mizpah? They found that no one from Jabesh Gilead had come to the camp for the assembly. It's way up in the northeast. No Jabesh Gileadites showed up. For when they counted the people, they found no one from Jabesh Gilead. And the assembly sent 12,000 fighting men there and ordered them, go and put the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead to the sword, including women and children. This is an Israelite town up in Reuben. This is what you are to do. Kill every male as well as every woman who is not a virgin. So all the men, all the wives. Among those living in Jabesh Gilead, they found 400 young virgins who had never slept with a man. They brought them to the camp at Shiloh in Canaan. But the whole assembly sent envoys to the Benjamites who were at the Rock of Ribbon. They had a flag of truce or whatever. What do they use for a flag of truce usually? Today? White flag? Where do you get a white flag? In the middle of a battle. Say it again. You take your t-shirt off. That's where you get a white flag. Most of our soldiers have khaki t-shirts today. It's a problem. I guess they can't surrender. I don't know. I won't say the obvious secondary source. The Benjamites returned at that time and were given the women who had been spared from Jabesh Gilead. So, the men are all there. They've lined up the virgin girls. What's the problem with bringing all the virgin girls? You know, some are 16, some are 15, some are 14. A couple are 11. Hey, Bob, you got a 9-year-old. You know, that kind of thing. Or whatever. So, not our Bob, but you know. I'm not sure exactly how they handled that. However, there were not enough for all of them. So the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made this gap in the tribes of Israel. The elders of the assembly said, what should we do about wives for those who are left since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed? And they said, there must be heirs for the survivors of Benjamin, so a tribe will not be wiped out from Israel. But we cannot give them our daughters as wives, for the Israelites had sworn anyone who gives a wife to a Benjamite is cursed. I want to take a minute and a half and talk about marriage in general as an application for us today. So remember that marriage, which is what we're talking about here at the end of the book, marriage is a gift from God to mankind. The primary purpose of marriage is companionship. Adam did not have a companion, remember? God gave him a companion. And Proverbs, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord. The companionship of marriage also enables us to serve God rather than the constant obsession with seeking out temporary companionship in an endless lifelong dating scene. Such a burden can often, not always, but often damage a frail ego and wear it away at a person's self-esteem and self-worth, which is not God's desire for us at all. He wants us to have a companion. Another purpose of marriage is that it's to be the means of procreation and having children. Sons are a heritage from the Lord, and so on. Proverbs or Psalm 127. Some couples might not be able to beget children in the natural way, but God still wants children to be raised within the family if possible, even if the children are adopted, or if a couple can be a good example for another couple, or as helping with cousins or the neighbor kids or what have you, but being there for them. And also, so that even a couple that can't have children can be an example of a good godly couple for other couples, because we forget about that. I had a wedding this weekend. I talked about that. And I didn't know very many of the people in the congregation. And so I talked about marriage with them in the sermon, and I talked about that marriage is not to be despised, that even people who, whether married, single, or widowed, divorced, whatever, we are to honor marriages around us and support them and not diminish them. Don't drive a word into somebody else's marriage with your words or even an eye roll or anything like, or a joke or something. But rather, you know, don't tease if that'll cause strife in the marriage. Build up other people's marriages. You know, we want marriages to be excellent, and it's a godly thing. And then by providing children with a stable home, God enables them to grow up without the fears and uncertainties that often result in an imbalanced life without married caregivers or role models. All kinds of problems happen, even where there's been a permitted divorce or a death. The children can become unbalanced because they don't have both parents in the scene. And it helps if the parents communicate even more. We often talk about, like, well, now, you know, madam, you've got to be both mom and dad to these children, or, you know, sir. And it requires more talk then about what is a healthy relationship, or kids can get the wrong ideas. Marriage also preserves chastity, that is sexual purity in men and women. Paul says it's better to marry than to burn with passion. Somebody constantly tempted by sexual urges needs to find a spouse so that those urges can be fulfilled. It's a brand new statistic I just heard. In the 21st century so far, you know, we're almost a quarter of the way in, aren't we already? It seemed like already, but yeah. The number of sexless marriages is about 1 in 4. 1 out of 4 marriages are a couple that has sex less than once a year. That's hideous. That can only lead to feelings of abandonment and inadequacy and frustration and temptations to do all kinds of things. It's awful. Following chastity, marriage offers freedom from one's passions, the devil's temptations enslave people to sin. God offers freedom from this slavery with a simple, elegant, lifelong gift of marriage. And finally, God blesses the fallen world by providing us with spouses who can make up for deficiencies that each of us has. It's a wonderful thing when a couple can become like, this is supposed to be the teeth of gears, where what he has lacking, she has. What she might be lacking, he has, and we end up just meshing beautifully, like gears that turn ideally like that. Just to finish off the chapter, a couple of verses. People now say they got a 200 girl deficit in Benjamin now, right? Soon there's an annual festival for the Lord at Shiloh. It's a state fair. And now look at the directions. Just a hint, hint, guys. Shiloh, north of Bethel, east of the road that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, on south of Labona. Like, just to make sure, wink, wink, you know exactly where this is going to be. And they instructed the Benjamites, go hide in the vineyard. So the very precise instructions to these Benjamite soldiers. You know, want woman. Okay, go here, stand here, wait. When you see the girl dance out, that's your chance. So watch, when you see the girls of Shiloh come out to dance, I was not kidding, each of you rush out of the vineyards and catch a wife for yourself from those girls of Shiloh and go back to the land of Benjamin. Okay? So out comes the music. I don't know what they played, and then they go on. When their fathers or brothers come to us and complain, we'll say to them, be favorable to them for our sake. We did not get enough wives for them during the war. You're not guilty of breaking your oath, since you did not give your girls to them. And this is what the Benjamites did. Got two verses left. When the girls were dancing, each man caught one and carried her off to be his wife. They went back to their own inheritance, rebuilt. Do you have a picture of a guy holding a girl like this, like under his arm or something like that, over his shoulder? Like, yeah. Ugh, got woman, you know. They went back to their own inheritance, rebuilt their cities, and settled in them. At that time, each of the Israelites returned from there to his own tribe and clan. Each went back to his own inheritance. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did whatever seemed right in his own eyes. It was a terrible time of confusion, of perversion, of terrible sins. And out of this miserable tribe of Benjamin, Saul is about to come onto the scene. This is the last verse of Judges. You've been listening to Invisible Church, the Bible study podcast from St. Paul's Lutheran Church, New Ulm, Minnesota.